Jules is the only person in the association that I've ever really cared about.
Well, David, I got to thank you for doing this. We've never done anything like this. I hate fucking interviews, to tell you the truth. I hate them. But this has been a total, total wonderful trip. And I really appreciate what you're doing.
Welcome to Discography, the podcast that gives Gen X music maniacs a chance to smell like teen spirit again by connecting with a brotherhood obsessed with rating the entire discography of every single artist and band that ever mattered. I'm your host, Dave Gebro, and with three new episodes each week, you're going to gain a comprehensive knowledge of an act's history and output in the time it takes to listen to one album. And in this episode, we'll be turning our spray cans on the association, along with our very special guests, the two founders of possibly the greatest soft pop act of all time, purveyors of such fine hits as Along Comes Mary, Cherish, Windy, and Never My Love, Terry Kirkman and Jules Alexander from the Association, in a five-part series called from an unprecedented 13-hour interview. This is the final part of the interview. In this episode, we tackle what it felt like to tumble so quickly from the charts, how many stars out of five Terry and Jules give 1971's Stop Your Motor, 1972's Waterbeds in Trinidad, and the slew of generic singles released throughout the 1970s and 80s, and the not-so-happy-sounding Happy Together tour, during which Terry insists their manager stole millions of dollars from his acts and invited Terry to take part. Coming up, we've got Bob Nastanovich, Deer Tick, Corey Hansen from Wand rating his own discography, and Mike Watt rating the entirety of the Minutemen's output. So don't miss out. Open up your listening app right now and subscribe. And away we go then with Terry Kirkman and Jules Alexander as we ascend the marshmallowy, pillow-soft contours of Mount Association. A vocal blend so magical, they seemed to exist in harmony with the winds that blew through the LA canyons, turned a 6- and 7-man mind cocoon, ruptured by personalities bursting through, fully formed from a shared bedrock of self-effacing anonymity. I was just telling Terry, I'm sure you guys are thrilled that this is coming to an end, but I woke up sad today. The thought of it, really, I mean, this has been epic.
David, I will receive your call through the rest of my life.
I appreciate that. Yeah, you guys too.
I'll grieve that you called me and asked me a question.
You know, a dream like that can only result in a wet dream.
Oh, boy. That sweat?
finally, Jules. Yes.
All right. So basically, what we have left is two records, some stray singles, and just talking about what's been going on with the band and your lives since then. So let's just go right into Stop Your Motor, unless you guys have anything you want to discuss before we start.
Dave has a short depth of field with a blurred background.
It was clear previous to this that you were a beautiful man, but now it's irrefutable.
Who are you talking to? I'm talking to you.
All right, here we go. That brings us to 1971's Stop Your Motor, which when it appeared in July 1971, this was your first full-length studio effort in 2 years, which to you guys was like 20 years based on the schedule your record company had you running around in circles with. So this was, just from a commercial perspective, not that this matters at all, but this was your least popular record up to that point, reaching only number 150 on the Billboard chart. Again, no hit singles. Again, not that that matters, because you guys were sort of doing your own thing, not really looking at what was bringing in the bacon and whatnot. It seems like this was more of a phase where you guys were in touch with the kind of aesthetic choices you guys wanted to make and fuck everything else. This was also your last Warner Brothers record. So just out of curiosity, what do you guys think accounted for the band's fall with regard to the success that you had been enjoying up to that point? Why did people seem to move on in 1971? And did it have an effect on you guys, or could you not give a rat's ass by that point?
What would you think? Given everything that you know now, why would you think we would be in that state?
All right. So if I was Terry or Jules, I'd be thinking, okay, maybe, you know, it's a Woodstock generation. It's a new world. Everyone's long haired. And, you know, maybe they think that Cherish is for squares. But the caveat to that is you guys are doing a different thing. You're bringing your harmonies. You're kind of bringing them into a different stylistic milieu, but you're doing a whole different thing. It's kind of akin to what the Eagles would soon be doing, but it's not really. You guys were truly following your hearts. So I think I might come up short with an actual response if I was in your shoes. How about you, Jules?
Well, I haven't put too much thought into this, to tell you the truth. You know, I mean, we were so deep into it, it's kind of hard to see the outside world, you know, from where we were.
You remember giving a shit or not giving a shit?
About what?
That your records were no longer charting.
Well, you got to give a shit. I mean, you know, but that's about it. We had to follow our creative things. We just had to. There was no choice. It's either that or follow somebody else's creative stuff, you know, and that had good consequences in some sense and just totally destructive consequences in another sense. Let me go step one back here to what I'm saying here. Bones Howe made a comment one time to us straight out. He said, you know, I'm not producing you guys. I'm producing Bones Howe.
Right.
And that about took care of Bones Howe for us.
Same with Boucher.
Well, Boucher, the thing was, Boucher, when we did the first album with him, he was producing us and he was working with us. There's a lot of Kurt's ideas and thoughts, but they really aligned with what we were doing musically. You know, he enhanced what we were doing musically and cleaned up what we were doing musically and added his stuff in there also. And that was a real nice thing. However, Kurt more or less started doing his thing and fuck us. I tell you what happened one time. I don't know if I told you about this, about the tracks he had. We were getting ready to do another album with him somewhere along the line. He was getting ready to do some stuff and he had a couple of songs that he was going to do with us. And he said, I want to do the tracks. Well, okay, sure. Go ahead, Kurt. I trust you. You know what we like. That's good. Right. So I walked into his studio one time with a couple of guys and he said, we're getting real close now to doing the vocals. And this was in the day of the 24 track. This was the absolute hottest thing that was on the market. There were no 32 tracks, no 48 tracks. I said, wow, we got a lot of vocals, man. I mean, you know, he knew that. I said, how many tracks we got to do this? And he said, well, we got two tracks. I said, what? He had taken all that time to get 22 tracks of his idea of instrumentals on. I said, that's not going to work. We're a vocal band, Kurt. Sure. I said, man, adios. I said, we can't do this. You know, we cannot put the association on two tracks, you know, and realized at that point, Kurt was not the guy for us.
Right.
So we went away. Same with Bones. That wasn't the case with Bones, but Bones was producing Bones. He wasn't producing us.
This was Ray Pullman, and then you had Don Randy handling vocal.
Yeah. Some of them. Yeah. Which were all great. You know, Ray, he was one of Terry's good friends. He was a really cool guy, man. But, you know, trusted him. Yeah, he's good.
And then along the way, Yester's song, I guess John Tartaglia and Randy Stierling had worked on those.
Yeah. Tartaglia went away also. He was, whoo, not good for us at all.
Pat Colicchio was just desperate to find anybody who could sit in the producer's seat and pull us together. Pat was very aware that we were lost.
Yep.
Now, when you say lost, do you mean in a commercial wilderness?
As a cohesive unit.
Right.
Forget the market. A whole bunch of shit had happened. Richard Thompson was in the group.
Right. So Russ is gone. Richard Thompson is in. Not the Richard Thompson of Fairport Convention.
I would rather have Richard Thompson that we had than the one from the Fairport Convention. Richard Thompson was
absolute genius and a keyboard player that was to die for.
He could rebuild your house. He could build a computer. He was teaching computer and he was teaching jazz when he died.
This is it's a really interesting record. I like this record. My least favorite thing about it is pacing wise.
There was no congruity. There was no overview. It was, can we get 12 tracks done?
Right.
What have we got lying around? So that I ended up like with the first sound from maybe Don Randy had something to do with the first sound because that was.
Yeah, that TV show. That's racing.
Coca-Cola thing that ended up being a complete fucking flop. I was cooked. I was done. Brian was really escalating in his drug use.
That's Race. And is this the only time, Terry, that you had collaborated with Brian? Well, you wrote the song and he sang it.
That all came together so fast. I probably wrote it in an hour. It was something that they wanted for the show. I wish that he had not sung it in his imitation Johnny Cash thing. It was actually popped by radio stations in the Southwest, namely Texas, as an airplay single. Obviously, Warner Brothers wouldn't back it at all, because it certainly didn't sound like an association thing, but it certainly could have been popped as a novelty record, since they weren't going to get any juice off that album anyway. I could not see us functioning the way we were past that album. I'm going to jump ahead a second here. Pat got ahead of himself, and I don't know exactly how it went down at all, and he certainly wasn't going to tell anybody. He got something from Clive Davis. He got $100,000 for us to sign to Columbia, and we had the meeting regarding that change, that huge change, at Ted Blushell's house on Mulholland Highway with the otters running around. I begged the group and Pat at that time to figure out a way in which we could take 3 or 6 months off. It really would have been nice in those dollars had we gotten $500,000 rather than $100,000. It would have been great if we got $1 million. Would have been great if we had somebody who was managing us who maybe could think in that way and say, look, you know, I've got a gold mine here between these guys, but they've lost cohesiveness with them. I talked about this at the beginning of our recording sessions, that my fantasy was that we would all find some place up around Pacific Grove in Monterey, and we'd get a big house, see if we could find it again, because we didn't have it.
Yeah,
we had ideas individually. Nobody was completely out of steam, but there was nothing on that album that came out of that time that I felt like in the production of that album that no one was really giving a shit what was happening with the song that was, it was up to bat at the time. Silver Morning, that's about as far away from my idea of Silver Morning as I could get.
Jesus, really?
Silver Morning is a great song. And I think there's some...
Yeah, it's cool.
I think there's some great stuff on this record. Hearing you guys talk about it, or certainly Terry, it's the opposite of what I was led to believe, which is that, you know, some of those early records, the vibe that I got out of, you know, reading the interviews you had done in the past, is that, you know, those records are more a reflection of the producer's stamp. And yet, from 69 on, that you guys were finally following your aesthetic hearts. I guess that's maybe not the case.
Correct. Although that's what we wanted to do. That's what we were hoping we could do.
The songs that I think are clear standouts on this one, P.F. Sloan's an obvious one. That's a great tune. Also, knowing his actual experience hearing the song. Do you know about that? You do, right? That he was at Pink's?
No.
He was
at
Pink's. It was 1971. He had borrowed money for coffee, and he was living on someone's couch. I'm quoting him now. He heard your version of the song, and his first thought was, God is still alive and remembers and loves me.
All right.
Because he had had all his royalties suspended. He had no money, no place to live, and he was trying to scrape up 50 cents for a hot dog. And the hot dog place started playing the song, P.F. Sloan, and he said he was thinking, is this a divine play or what? I think that's pretty cool. And then, Terry, your Silver Morning, it's literally you just waking up from your house, opening up the windows, and this is the song you wrote from what you saw and experienced, right?
I didn't open the windows. They were open.
What an asshole.
In those days with the smog, I had a little balcony right off of my bed. Judith's in my bed, and I could go stand on it, and I'm at the Hollywood sign, which just got a lot of attention because of the snow that we had, and it snowed at the Hollywood sign, but the big deal is that it's so low to the ground. It's only about 1,300, 1,400 feet, so I am a good 250 feet lower than the Hollywood sign, even though I'm the closest house to the Hollywood sign. And I could stand on my balcony or in the A-frame window and not see the fucking city below me. I mean, it wasn't there. There was nothing sticking out. It was a solid cushion of brown shit. That's how bad the smog was.
I remember that. Oh, Jesus.
There were days when I called the group up. And I don't think I want to come down and sing in that shit. You guys are welcome to come up and sing in it. Above it, Jim was right at the toe of the canyon I was in, and Russ was halfway up the canyon.
David, about Terry's house, you see pictures of the Hollywood sign, and you'll see an A-frame down there at the bottom of it. That's the house. That was Terry's house.
A lot of your stuff from this time sounds very sad to me. It sounds like you were deep in thought, not a happy person at this time.
I wasn't. The sound was correct. I wasn't conscious of it at the time. But people would say to me, you sound really tired.
Right. There is an exhaustion to it, which is understandable. You're going nonstop for 5 years now.
But also, one of the things that came out of these sessions that we've done here is that when I left the group finally in very early 72, I guess it was, and I was 32 years old, Judith and I, when we sold the A-frame, we rented another house while we were looking for a place that we actually wanted to live in. And the reason we got out of the A-frame was we had a neighbor who was actually kind of dangerous. And the whole neighborhood had sued him, and the neighborhood had lost. We just turned around and said, well, I think it's time to go. We ended up getting this piece of property at the top of Laurel on Woodrow Wilson. And we were the second owners in a 35-year-old house that our real estate agent did not want to show us because it was so rustic. So we ended up in that house.
If this was a single, I think this would have been a hit.
I lived in the house for 2 years. I built myself my own dream come true studio, Redwood. I had a huge pool. I had all this shit, just all this old 35-year-old shit. I never plugged in my stereo. I never unpacked the boxes. I didn't do anything. Huge life-changing, relationship-changing shit with my wife. Woulda, coulda, shoulda, just got packed up and left then. But that was too big a move for me to leave the group and leave her.
Hey, lads and ladies, Dave Gebro here. I abandoned my career and moved my family 3,000 miles to be able to focus exclusively on Discog Graffiti. And so if you're like me, and enough is just never enough, then please visit patreon.com/discograffiti and become one of our Patreon soldiers of sound. Discog Graffiti is an entirely listener-supported show, and it's also intended to be a 3 times a week music deep dive experience. So do us both a favor and consider giving it a shot. Trust me, I'm working hard for the money, so hard for it, honey. There's the main show on Friday, a Monday wildcard episode, which is either a soul-bearing interview with that week's special guest, or an offshoot show like Queasy Listening and Rock Cousteau. And then on Wednesdays, there's the humdinger of them all, Discog Graffiti's The Top 10. You got nothing to lose. If you don't dig it after a month, you're refunded. No questions asked. Once again, that's patreon.com/discograffiti.
The thought that I was having coming out of these sessions is that much later on, I got diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease.
I have that too.
Hashimoto's is hypothyroid. Before then, I was diagnosed with a -9 metabolism. And then when I lived and worked all around the Park La Brea, there were the statues of the giant sloth there. And I would just go by and tear up because I felt so much kindred with the giant sloth.
Yep.
I have to think about and organize myself to get up and go fucking get a glass of water. There was a period of time where I was so out of juice. Years later, after leaving the group the first time in an early recovery, which would have a lot to do with it. Number one, I was suicidal. I had in and out thoughts of suicidality. But I was working as a professional writer, and I would work on a paragraph.
What year is this?
I'm jump cutting to the early 90s.
90s? Wow.
Yeah, this is right when I'm finally diagnosed with Hashimoto's.
Jesus. Well,
I'd write a paragraph, work on it, say for an hour, and then have to get up and go to sleep. I would have to go to sleep before I could work again. My body was done. Now, the reason I'm saying this is that I was done when I left the group the first time when I was 32 years old. I mean, I was done. I never wanted to be on stage again and sing with the group again. I couldn't imagine myself doing that again. I got involved in things that I felt very passionate about, but I couldn't find anything that I could land on that was going to be someplace I wanted a homestead again. But done at 32.
Well, so let's stay in Stop Your Motor, because I want to touch on all these things as they happen.
But I really like the title of that, because it stopped my fucking motor.
Right.
Mm. I had almost no contribution at all in Waterbeds of Trinidad.
So side two of the record is, again, you have It's Gotta Be Real, which I love. I love the original version of that, Larry's contribution to Goodbye Columbus. This one's even better, I think. But again, it's a carryover. It had existed before. Then your track, The First Sound, which you wrote with Richard Thompson, it feels like an introduction to the kind of Muzak-y moves that you guys would be getting into, you know, in the mid to late 70s. I love Brian Cole's song, Traveler's Guide, Spanish. And I mean, it's kind of confusing, because up to this point, Brian is doing, admittedly, some pretty Johnny Cash intensive pastiche work as a vocalist. But here, he sounds like a dead ringer for Cat Stevens. It's really weird. I think Traveler's Guide is Brian's most pro move on the mic. I think it's his greatest vocal and his most sophisticated song with the most intricate melodic twists. Do you guys know if he'd been working on this one for a while before hitting the studio?
I had no relationship whatsoever.
Yeah, it's really hard to say, because Brian was not much of the group at that time. He was out doing things.
Okay.
He was away from the group mostly.
So from the previous album to this one, is this the biggest change that you saw in Brian?
I don't know. I think it was the compilation of the changes he was going through. A lot of stuff had been going on with him that we didn't know about and still don't.
So you're not even just talking about heroin. You're talking about the company he
kept. His whole lifestyle, everything. He was in a different world, man.
Did he ever come into the group and try to introduce that to you guys?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, he did. Okay.
Yeah.
Were there any takers?
Not really. Not really, because he was too out of it. I don't know. Yeah. Personally, that's speaking for myself, but I don't think so. Ted and he were kind of close. Jim and no. Jim wasn't that close to him. Beside Ted, I don't think so.
Brian reached out to me in a very, very unforgettable way. Right after the release of Stop Your Motors, my dad died. Quite unexpectedly. The group was upstate New York. I got the first phone call at Syracuse, finished out. He'd had a heart attack. He was in Pomona Valley Hospital, 4 miles from where I am right now. And I finished off the last night of that leg of the tour and flew home by myself the next day. When I returned, we were in Minot, North Dakota, and we got snowed in.
Oh, that one, yeah. It was 20 below or 40 below or something.
It was a pretty cool hotel. That's what I remember. It had those low roofs that you'd go to get a clam roll.
Howard Johnson's?
Yes.
Yes. There you go, man.
And it had those kind of low ceilings to it.
Yeah.
What did Brian say to you?
He just invited me to his room, maybe to have a hit off of a joint or whatever. And he laid out, and it was the first empathic conversation I'd had with him in fucking years. He really wanted to talk to me. And he also wanted to talk about himself. He wanted to talk about bisexuality, etc. And nothing came of that conversation other than, this has really been nice, thank you very much. But it was so real, and there was nothing that preceded it, there was nothing that happened afterwards. It was like
he was trying to build up to ask for some kind of help, or not really?
I think he was reaching out to me because he felt empathic. My father just died.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I think that was probably closer to his truth than the image that he worked so hard to create to me, that he was unavailable, that he was kind of a right-wing thug. Brian was the only guy in the group that ever said, I'm going to break both your fucking arms.
Well, thank God for that, because you don't need more than one person saying shit like that.
Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah.
Telling me that you're going to break both of my arms, I don't give a fuck what your size is or who you are or anything. I say, That was said with confidence, I think I'll leave the room, right?
Yeah, that's a good response.
Yeah.
So the final song on the record is Seven Virgins, which I think is great. Jimmy Spheeris is an awesome singer-songwriter, and it was a well-chosen track, I think. Overall, I think Stop Your Motor is a definite improvement over the eponymous record, but it's marked for me by some definitive pacing problems. There's like a few wobbly songs at first, I think, then three great ones in a row, then a couple clunkers, then two great ones. I think it's exactly half great and half wobbly, but ultimately I give it 3 stars and I think it's a solid piece of work. What do you guys give this one?
Hard to say. Hard to say because some of my stuff that was on it was good because I was able to do some of the things I wanted to do musically.
Funny kind of song.
Yeah. That one, that was a true song sort of thing.
Well, you had a really good relationship with Ray Pulbeck.
Yeah. I really liked him.
Jules, that's your only song on the record. Funny
kind of. Yeah, I know. I felt I could do some things musically in that whole production that worked for me. There was that, oh, yeah, I like that, or that, oh, that works here, and so on and so forth like that. No matter what the outcome of it, good, bad, or indifferent. Right. You know? So that's about it. So I would give it, for me, a 4 because that's what it meant to me.
Yeah.
Didn't mean shit to anybody else. That's okay. And I really don't care about that.
How about you, Terry?
I probably agree with you, Dave. I don't think about that album much. I'm always surprised that, oh, that song was on that album. Oh, my God, we did that.
So you're a 3-star, Terry?
Yeah. What we're doing here is you need a rate, and I know you're going to persevere, so I'm going to give you your 3.
I wore you down that quick. Okay, so
he gets easy after a while.
We're not just rating, we're curating.
Give me a number, Terry. Give me a number.
All right, so
give me a number.
The final record that is until this year, 1972's Waterbeds in Trinidad. In early 1972, you guys resurfaced on Columbia with Waterbeds in Trinidad, which got to number 194. Produced by Louis Merenstein, who produced one of my all-time favorite records, Astral Weeks by Van Morrison. Yeah, this one, you guys released a single of The Lovin' Spoonful's Darlin' Be Home Soon, which didn't even break the top 100.
We didn't release...
The record company.
It had nothing to do with the rest of the album. And it became clear to me, because I was out of there after that, that that's where and how Clive Davis was going to see us. That he wasn't going to seek anything new from us.
For the past 40 years, Mike Stax's Ugly Things magazine has been bringing its readers in-depth stories about the greatest overlooked music of the 1960s and beyond. It's actually the longest-running independent rock and roll fanzine in the world. Ugly Things is now also a podcast. The Music Machine, Moby Grape, Love, Clear Light, Gabor Szabo, The Troggs, John's Children, The Velvet Underground, and more, all illuminated by exclusive interviews, conversations, and musical highlights. Like Discograffiti, Ugly Things takes you deep into the music and the lives of the people who made it. Most podcasts are only skin deep. Ugly Things cuts to the bone. The Ugly Things Podcast. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This record, before we even get into the specific music, I think this is your best post-1968 record. For the second half of your career, this is my favorite one. This is the last album that Brian Cole's on, but this is not the last released recording, because in 73, he actually appears on Names, Tags, Numbers, and Labels. But let's talk about the music on this record. It's a really interesting record. Starts off with a great Ron Davies cover of Silent Song Through the Land, which is excellent. Again, Larry hitting it out of the gate with his vocal, and the harmonies on the chorus are sparkling. Darling Be Home Soon, I could take it or leave it. It's a cover, and I like the originals you guys do. So to me, that's sort of a stopgap thing. It's a solid cover. Then comes Midnight Wind. You know, Jules, you were loving this kind of jazzy soft rock at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your work in Bijou was even more impressive than this kind of stuff, because I feel like
you
doubled down on that. And, you know, like I've told you before, I really wish there was more material from that. I would have loved to have heard some of that stuff. Did you ever hear the Sopwith Camel record? Not Hello, Hello from the 60s. They came back in the early 70s. And the only correlative that I can think of to what you were doing in the early 70s is their record from the early 70s, which I think you would love. It's this style of music, and you would hit a hot streak because you were producing stuff like this. It was all sort of a piece. And I guess the pejorative way of looking at it, like Terry had said, is that it's just a bunch of tracks. There's no cohesion. The interpretation that I take away from that is that in 1966, you guys sounded like it was the work of one songwriter because it was the group mind. And now you guys are coming into your own, and we have Terry doing the country rock, Jules doing the jazzy soft rock. Everyone's got their own niche, which makes it more interesting to me. Come the Fall, I really like Come the Fall. What are your thoughts?
I like it very much. It's a real good tune, I think. I got to tell you, though, for a while we had a bass player named Wolfgang Mells. Wolfgang was probably the best bass player I've ever played with and known. He was as fast as Pastorius. Just amazing. An amazing drummer. Horrible alcoholic. I mean, really bad. But he used to get drunk and sing Come the Fall with a German accent. Come sie fall, come sie fall, come sie fall, when it's all said and done. Young God, I can't get away from that.
He also did Cherish. Cherish is the word
I used to describe.
Right. Yeah.
Terry, tell me, am I looking too hard for clues here? So when I'm looking at the lyrics to this song, I've been playing out of tune, sitting smug in my balloon, strung out of my long, phony life. First of all, is any of this stuff balloon and strung out, any of this reference to Brian or no?
Not in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
This song has nothing to do with any outside thing except my head. Mm. And it was my swan song with the Associates. I never recorded another note.
Is this your goodbye to the band?
Went through the 80s, not a note of anything that I'd written. If you listen to it, so this is recorded in 1971, am I correct?
72.
So it's 12 years before I'm going to get sober, right? And it is as prescient as can be.
Boy, really, those lyrics, Terry, that's just amazing. I love those lyrics in there. It's so good.
But never performed by the group on stage, ever. The lyrics were a complete fourth and fifth and ninth step for me in terms of the 12 steps. I've shared it at meetings. Take a look inside your soul, sort out all the things you stole. Return them to their owners if you can. Things like trust, love, and time, the other person's place in line. If you tell the truth, I think they'll understand. But I didn't know that. That just came from me in such a organic, I would choose the word organic.
And man, you sound super Hashimoto'd on it. You sound tired.
I was exhausted.
Yeah.
And I hated what had become to us. I was really hating what was becoming to me, inside and outside the group, both.
What was becoming of you?
I was not a happy camper. I was really disappointed. Everything that we had staked our claim to, my marriage, show business, the niche that I thought I had accidentally found and had hoped that I had found in show business, it just wasn't working at all. I had not taken a couple of offers that were offered and they were long gone.
You're talking about Geffen.
That and some other things. I hated the kind of detachment I felt within the group that I don't think had anything to do with anybody else, that I had fostered myself. There was a detachment with Jules, there was a detachment with Richard Thompson, and things that I had hoped would be really, really long-term relationships. You know, it was like a marriage. It's really about as intimate as you're going to get. The love-object relationship. The love-object relationship is a relationship you almost always have unless you're gay. You have it with a member of the same sex. If you're heterosexual, you have it with a member of the same sex. And they know more about you than your spouse is ever going to know. I felt done, lost.
Yeah.
The people that we got weren't of our choice. We didn't choose Lou Marinstein. Clive Davis did. And we didn't choose Benny Golson. Clive Davis did. Fucking Benny Golson. The band that he had doing the basic tracks, they could have been phoning it in. I know for a fact that the drummer really hated being in the room with us.
Even with all that, the consistency on this record is pretty stunning.
It's pretty stunning because Benny Golson had his hand on the wheel. That wasn't the association. We did not have our hand on that wheel. Benny and what's his name from the High Lows?
Clark Burrows.
If we had been studio singers, you would have come through and say, good fucking album.
I might be wrong in assuming this, but just based on the track listing, I'm guessing that Jules' experience here was different because Jules has three tracks on this record. Is it three or four?
Four, I think.
Four.
I mean, Jules was kind of on fire.
When I left the group in Maryland, I did not announce that I was leaving the group until we were at the last gig that I performed with them. Jules was in the car with me. We were driving around after the show or whatever. Jules says, you know what? I'm going to leave the group too. And I said, you got to be fucking nuts. You have four really good songs on an album that I hope is going to do something. I would really stay put. I'd really stay put and see where this goes. This is the best shot you've had in a long, long time. And it's a fresh start.
Yeah, because Jules, you were making vital, viable work, Kicking the Gong Around, Rainbow's Bent, Please Don't Go Around the Bend. This was not a look back
interview.
Yeah.
Great stuff. That it was solely from him, Jules. It was solely from you. And I thought, what a cool thing. What a cool thing to have a platform dumped in your lap that you really clicked with. Because the association did not have a platform that was going to avail itself to anybody.
The two songs that are noteworthy mentions in addition to that is Indian Wells Woman, which is, I think, a great Ramos song. You don't like that one, really?
Me either.
Oh, really? How come?
Anybody that's got to go write a song about a fucking woman.
Yeah, that they met on the back road. It's like, what?
Okay.
I
like that one. But what I really want to focus on, though, is Little Road and a Stone to Roll. Because, you know, this is your last song as a band, on a record at least. It's a perfect capper, and it's a Brian Cole performance.
Yeah.
A lot of appreciation from fans.
Yeah. It's interesting. On the first album, I can't tell your songwriting apart. And by now, I know exactly who's who. That was the problem, but that's life, too. Jules was the one on fire here, I think. It's your most surprising later era album to me. Notwithstanding commercial responses, it showed you guys pointing in, to me, what is a promisingly creative and vital future direction that folded in that minor key soft jazz thing that you were doing, behind which your vocal blend remained undiminished. It's a solid LP. I'll give it 3.5 stars.
3.5?
Yeah. How about you guys?
I think as a cohesive, interesting body of work, I would give it 4 stars for pretty much doing what it set out to do. Indian Wells Woman would kind of ruin it for me.
You guys hate that song.
And maybe even come the fall, in terms of having one really unique voice all the way through.
Wait, Jules, did you rate this yet? No, you haven't.
No, I did not give it 4 because the tunes I did, they really came through. I felt very, very comfortable with those tunes, you know, and how they did it. But that same thing, Indian Wells Woman, I don't like it. Okay, I love Terry's songs.
So you guys are out on tour. You brought in Wolfgang Melds on bass, Mike Berkowitz on drums.
Yeah.
So that Brian and Ted could focus on singing. And then August 2nd, 1972, Brian was found dead in his home.
Yeah.
Now, I want to get your take on this, because that next month, Terry, you're gone. Did anyone else leave besides Melz and Berkowitz?
Russell.
Berkowitz was dropped because I brought him into the group.
Terry, when Brian passed away, you didn't leave the group because Brian passed away. That was just like an external validation of all these things you had been feeling already, that it was over. Is that what happened? For your departure, what would you say was the chief reason why you left? Was it Brian's passing?
Been going on for a while. I think that mentally, I left the group coming out of Stop Your Motor. I couldn't stand to pack my fucking bags and go on another tour.
The interesting thing about you didn't go on to a solo career. This was kind of it.
Well, that's been asked and answered non-chronologically throughout all of this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I didn't belong on the road. I really didn't. All the way back at the time that we met at Jim's house 5 years before. for Goodbye Columbus. And Jim and I, unbeknownst to each other, had come with a mandate for management that we quit working as hard as we worked. We were in two different trivia books as the hardest working band of the 60s. That wasn't a compliment. That was about how fucking dumb and suicidal could you be? It would be something if you were the Christy Minstrels. It would be something if you were a cover band. If you weren't the creative juices, you were the Les Baxter Balladeers, or you were an act that didn't create your act, you just performed it well, that'd be one thing. But if you're looking for the group is the artist, that the group mind is the artist, that it's our songs, and we are going to spend 6 months to a year recording an album like the Eagles, like Brian Wilson, 6 months with Good Vibrations, that we're going to be taken seriously as a creative entity, and we no longer were. It was like, oh, let's see what those guys have got.
Throughout the rest of the 70s and 80s, it was like a throwing in the towel as far as how history was seeing you guys, because then you kind of went with it.
There were things happening in the world. I started to have a global consciousness. The first thing that I did after I got out of the association, after being really, really sick, dangerously, life-threateningly sick when I got out for about a month, I was already involved with an outfit called EIPJ, Richard Thompson and I.
Oh, I remember that.
Entertainment Industry for Peace and Justice, with Jane Fonda and a bunch of other droppable names. And I got involved with the Vietnam Information Project, which was Tom Hayden. Tom Hayden and I were born on the same day. And it was really serious. And it was something that I was looking for my entire life. And I'd had glimpses of it before. And I'm not going to bore you guys with that story, although it's pretty much how I roll in terms of my moral compass. The Vietnam Information Project, you took an issue, you took an event, and you researched it to the absolute furthest that you could possibly go, which meant you couldn't grab it and just garner some information like a reporter and then hit the road with it. The Plain of Jars was the one that I drew. And we talked about the Plain of Jars, and we talked about how nothing would ever grow in the Plain of Jars ever again, probably, except fungus. It had been so defoliated, so killed. What made a difference was that we operated from a script, and the script was, to the best of anybody's capacity at that moment, was absolutely unimpeachably true. There was not a hot word in the entire presentation. It was like a scientific analysis of what happened there, period. No hyperbole, none of this, none of the horrible United States, no nothing, just this place exists, and this was the history behind it, and this invading force came in, the one more invading force after 2,000 years of invasion. And in my head, I wanted my whole life to be like that. And show business did not fit. Certainly being the director of the creative department of Motown did not fit that. I did that for 7 months, and it's not even on my resume. Get me the fuck out of here.
Jules, what was your feeling that Terry was gone? Did it cross your mind to throw in the towel as well?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I did, ultimately, anyway.
So actually, let me say, this is where phase three comes in for me. So I'm calling phase three reminding the universe of its slow dancing youth for the remainder of eternity. 1972 to 2023. Which I'm hoping a phase four is going to come out of that with the new work you guys are doing. This phase kicks off with Names, Tags, Numbers, and Labels. This is a key song for me because when I hear this song, this portends to me, the vibe that it gives off is, if this is who you want us to be, then fine, we'll be that. Am I reading into it?
Of course, but you should. I mean, that's what it's there for, you know. Okay, yeah. Go ahead, you know, and read into it. It's all right.
Well, I mean, you guys didn't write this. This is Albert Hammond.
Yeah, it's Albert Hammond. We played with him one time in Delaware. We played when he was first over here. I think he had one hit, his first hit, Never Rains in Southern California. He already had that out. And we played with him.
That was my last gig, my very last gig.
That song, though, names, tags, numbers, label, I didn't care all that much about it. It was interesting, but I never listened to it all that much. It didn't speak to me.
No, I give that one 2 stars. I mean, to me, that's the first generic piece of work.
All right, yeah.
To me, I can take that K-Telt collection you did in the 80s, and I could trace it back to this song.
Yeah, it sounds right.
Aesthetically.
Yeah.
It's a little bit chaotic now for a couple of years, right? Jim left in the summer of 73, mm-hmm. replaced by Jerry, his brother. Mm-hmm. Then Jim came back mm-hmm. when Jules, you left in late 73, right? Mm-hmm. And you joined Russ and...
we put Bijou together.
That stuff's really... I love it. All I've heard is Carry On and Take Me Home to the Dawn, the single.
Take Me Down to the Dawn. Yeah. So there's a couple more. I'll send you one or two of them. There's two more.
Were you guys planning on making a record or were you?
Oh, yeah, we did. We had a contract with A&M, but they dropped us after a short time because they thought we looked too much like the SLA. You know, instead, I'm not kidding. That's their exact words.
That's funny.
Do you have a contract or a single deal?
Well, they paid for 4 tunes.
That's a single
deal. I think it was a singles deal.
Yeah, I had taken a whack at being a manager during that time, but somebody else asked me to join him, and it was, you know, again, that's not on my resume. But I took a lot of people to A&M, and A&M wanted me. We almost closed a deal where I was going to be one of A&M's songwriters, Irving Allman.
Oh, cool.
And the guy that was going to sign me got caught with his hand in the pot the day Ooh. That he was going to sign me.
Oh, great.
Shit.
So God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. Irving Allman would sign almost any band that was together and actually had anything, would sign almost anybody to a singles deal, and then they'd see what you did with it, and then they would turn around and they would release a record if they didn't like you, if they didn't want to go forward. They would seal the fate by releasing maybe the least potential cut from the sides that you cut. Elektra did that to us with Bones Howe when we got back together in the 1980s.
Right.
They dropped the least likely successful song and did nothing to promote it.
In 1975, the single One Sunday Morning with Life as a Carnival came out. Neither of you guys are on there.
No,
right?
We're not.
That I give 1.25 stars. I think it's pretty dreadful.
Yeah, you're very generous.
I am generous, but I love you guys. So, you know, if I didn't know who you were, if it was just some random group, I'd probably give it 0. In 75, to follow that up, Sleepy Eyes with the Elton John song, Take Me to the Pilots on the B-side. That I give 1.75 stars. You guys are on RCA Records at this point, and you have an album that was supposed to come out called The Association Bites Back, and that was never released.
We had nothing to do with that stuff.
So the band, which is not you guys at this point, but the band in general, was offered a production deal with Mike Curb, who wanted the Association to record a disco version of Cherish, No Fair at All, and an original song called It's High Time to Get High.
Oh, geez, oh boy, fuck.
Then Ramos departs in mid-75, and in 77, Ted, Jim, and whoever was involved at that point recorded new versions of Windy, Cherish, Never My Love, Along Comes Mary, and Everything That Touches You for the K-Tel thing that later wound up on a 1983 collection called Back to Back, where you had the Turtles on one side, you guys on the other. At this point, whoever was behind the wheel was not actually driving the car either. Basically, your legacy was fraying. Everyone was kind of asleep. What are you guys doing at this point in your lives in the late 70s?
Jesus.
Because by the summer of 77, Yester had gone and Ted was the only original member. And then the band dissolved shortly after that. And Ted apparently had a huge debt from what I read. And to help clear away some of the debt, in November 78, released the group's name to a company that put a fake association out on the road. Did you guys even care?
Well, I was involved in my stuff. I really didn't care. Whatever they did, they did. It doesn't make any difference to me.
In September 79, this is when that program came about, right? To reunite you guys at the Ambassador Hotel's Coke. open at Grove Nightclub.
Yeah, yeah.
For an HBO special called Then and Now.
Well, you asked earlier, what were we doing years? I was being a data analyst. I went to work for this computer company when Windows 3.1 was the hot thing out there, right? And I knew about that program because I'd been involved in computers here and there and everywhere. I went and applied and they hired me right away. Anyway, so I went with this company and I was with this company for 16 years. Ended up being the lead data analyst in this one part of the company. So I was playing computer boy for those years.
Were you excited to have a different focus in your life, or were you DJ?
Well, very much, because the thing was, what I was doing was very creative and it was putting together abstract concepts and making them whole, just like music, right? Putting together abstract feelings and making them whole. So I was very happy with that gig. And I put down the guitar and I did not play the guitar for 16 years. You know,
not at all, like not even.
Not at all. Of course, that's one of the reasons right there. I was building a boat and got my thumb caught up in the table saw and whacked off about half of it. And that was already after I hadn't been playing for 5 or 8 years anyway. So I figured, okay, the universe is just putting a period on what I already decided to do.
Yeah.
You know, and that was okay. But then later on, Larry Ramos was getting more ill and more ill and more ill. And I was friends with the band. I talked to Russ every now and then. I talked to everybody, you know, so on and so forth. And Russ called me up and he said, look, Larry's getting so sick he cannot go on the road. He was having dialysis and he couldn't go on for a couple of days. And he says, would you come and stand in for him at this one particular gig, a couple of gigs? I said, well, yeah, I think. And I went without playing, you know, and sang and so on and so forth like that.
What year would you say this is?
This was, well, I moved to Texas in 88. So this is about 90, I guess, maybe somewhere in there.
Let's talk about the early 80s first.
Okay. Early 80s.
There was like a last flush where you guys, and again, it was what you guys were alluding to. Mm-hmm. Sal comes back in the picture. You have a short-lived deal with Elektra Records.
Yeah.
Dreamer reunites you with Bones Howe and actually makes the Hot 100 with almost no promotion whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
Pat Colecchio's back in your life and you guys are on a tour. Terry, you did 4 years with the band at this point. What happened here? Because this is right before you got sober, right? So I gotta assume this was a really fucked up time.
It was really fucked up.
Was it?
No, it was about as bad an idea as I could have. I'm going to talk about me. I had just been the director of the creative department at Motown. I knew coming out of the Iranian oil crisis that the concept of vinyl records at that time was so bad and that record companies hadn't replaced it. They didn't know what they were going to do. So coming out of that, a real frame of reference would be Aretha Franklin. If she popped a record, they would press 1 million and they were pressing 100,000 because that was the vinyl allocation. CBS, Columbia, in all of its hugeness, it was about 25 different labels and release outlets. About 85% of its releases at the time were in the top 100. And they were the hottest label in the country. And they were looking to fire half of their staff and close up half of their thing because that 85% did not add up to enough records to keep the record company afloat. You were in a crisis that was not going to be surmounted by anybody's talent. Elektra was dropping Judy Collins. They were dropping all these acts. Ultimately, that would take out Joni Mitchell. Tried to fire up an act that had been off the stove for a really, really long time was just a horrible fucking idea. We originally had about $25,000 that was invested in the group in 1980.
I got to say, by the way, that I think Dreamer is the best song that you guys did post-1972.
Well, good.
For whatever that's worth.
Because that's what we were going to do. I'd be out the door in 16 seconds.
I give that 3 stars if that tickles your gonads any.
Good. As a consumer, cool. As an artist, I don't even understand it.
Also, Small Town Lovers.
The same guys that wrote that also wrote The Backseat of Heaven, which was a wonderful song. I don't think that we nailed it, but it was a wonderful tune. And to this day, I can't remember the guys that wrote those two songs, and I've always wanted to know them and tell them how much I like their work.
I especially like Across the Persian Gulf on the flip.
Well, that's Jerry Yester. Had Jerry Yester continued with us, that's sort of what the association was looking for, was somebody who had the ability to really help us form yet that next level of sound and cohesion. We're going to get to that because there were five songs that the association recorded at Sunwest Recorders.
During the same time in 81?
During 80.
Okay. In 81, you guys were actually doing good work. I thought so anyway. I mean, it wasn't going to revolutionize.
So we were, and there was no market for us. It wouldn't take A&R, it would take PR to create a story, to create a, you know, let me turn on that channel, let me turn on that station. You're talking about a really dead period in American art.
Oh, yeah.
What I said before is that knowing what I did, but going in with the association and my alcoholism was really starting to kick in at that time. Everything was wrong with that idea, I knew. I knew every single fucking thing, how bad, phenomenally bad an idea that was. And I did it anyway because I was in between jobs.
Right.
I was hired to fire somebody at Motown, and I didn't fire him.
Do you feel like your time with the association in the early 80s hastened your entrance into recovery? Well, because, I mean, maybe your drinking would have continued into the 80s, the 90s.
No, I left the band on September 14th.
Yeah, in 84.
And I went to my first AA meeting October 21st.
So in that month and a half, what happened? Or don't you remember any of it?
Oh, I was suicidal.
Were you?
Yeah. I was devastated, mortified, embarrassed, really defeated. I'm still not over David Fishoff.
Who was your manager at that time?
Millions of dollars from his acts. Millions and millions, and invited me to be a part of the theft. Up front, as the Happy Together tour began, I put the idea of creating an oldies tour together for David, and he took the bait and created it, and then came back and he offered me 2% of the gate. And I turned him down. We never, ever, ever, ever saw an original contract on the Happy Together tour. Not one. He was four-walling us, cutting his deal up front with the promoters, and then he and whoever the New York guy was with William Morris, they were taking out every third contract of the Happy Together tour, and it was never being recorded, so they were taking the whole gate. David called me two or three times to ask me to help him put together ideas for fraudulently representing old acts as a record company. And real, honest-to-God, psychotic guy. Scared the shit out of people who tried to rescue us, like Ken Fritz.
On the recovery front, though, on October 21st, 84, did that meeting that you went to, was that an aha moment, or did it take a while for you to really wrap your mind around this thing?
September 5th, I had a meeting with David Fishoff. I was, quote unquote, the leader of the band. Just I hadn't been for a long time because he shoved me up front and began creating his own deal. I had created a vision for the group that whether it was a good vision or not, it was workable to get us off the road that we were on. We were never home. We'd be home for 4 days and back out on the road again. I'm talking about the Happy Together tour. I'm talking about 1984.
Yeah,
I went into David's office. I had split off from the band to go see my wife, who was in Buffalo during the filming of the baseball classic movie that Redford was in.
The Natural.
Yeah. And I went up there to visit her, the producer of that, and his wife, who were friends. And I took the train. The band was in Philadelphia. And that's where I was going to hook up with the band again. So I took a train into New York City, went to 57th and Broadway, the corner, and that's where David's office was. And I went up. He had no idea what was stopping in town. I bopped into his office. I was a cocaine addict, so I'm really fucking crazy. And I walk into his little cubicle, and it scared him, because because he had begged me not to be angry at him in public. And he said, well, what are you doing here? I said, I just have a question. Besides four wall in our own ship, is there any way we can keep you from stealing from us? And he looked at me and he laughed and said, that's the question? And I said, yes. He said, no, you can't stop me from stealing from you. I own you lock, stock, and fucking barrel. I said, thank you.
So you leave in 84, but Jules, you're still hanging on till 89, right?
The whole band is in this. And after I left the thing, sometime after, they actually caught David doing what he did, where he was offering the band $60,000 for a $160,000 contract. I got that from Russ. He owes his acts. Millions of dollars. Millions and millions and millions of dollars. He's a psychopath.
So Jules,
there is no deal until he gets a kickback.
Jules, how come you...
Hold on, Terry. What'd you ask?
So I just wanted to know, you know, Terry's gone in December 84, but you hung in there for almost five more years. You split in early 89. So what kept you in there knowing that there was all this insanity going on under your roof?
I didn't know there was all this insanity going on.
Okay.
Terry's very quiet about it. Every now and then he'd mention something, but, you know, he was quiet about it. But,
I brought it up pretty much with everybody. You understand that I'm not too sane at the time myself.
So anyway, I was answering what he was asking me, Terry, okay?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you were I'm sorry.
No. In those years, there wasn't much going on recording-wise, so on and so forth like that.
Yeah.
I was just hanging in there. That's all. But Larry and I started really getting on each other's nerves. I mean, we had totally different ideas about life and things, you know. Finally, I realized that I was getting nowhere there, you know, so I just had to quit. So I just did quit. You know, simple as that. You know, there's no big deal there. Well, it was a big deal, but it wasn't, you know, it was just that's what happened.
Yeah.
You know, I had already moved to Texas.
It had to have been difficult for you. You know, I have this idea of who you are, but the idea that I have, whether correct or incorrect, is that you're a searcher and a seeker.
Yeah.
You're looking for a deeper meaning in life. And so to have that concept, at least the concept of that person within this kind of setting where not only are you just standing in place with no forward motion whatsoever, but really you're kind of sinking because, you know, the legacy of this great band is kind of being trampled upon. You know, you're doing cassette tapes, you're doing Radio Shack stuff. I mean, you did a cover of Walk Away Renee for Radio Shack. And so the idea of this guy who's, you know, got Bijou, which is this forward-looking group, kind of revolutionary, and, you know, leaving his band at the height of their success to go to India. It's hard to reconcile with this guy who stays in the group through all of the 80s.
Well, I don't think my life is that much different from a lot of people, you know, who were seeking, for lack of a better word. You know, you've got the world and you've got the inner world, you know, and that same situation occurs with all of us. You know, here you got the world on this hand and there's money and there's this and or lack of money and there's all this shit going on. And internally, there's stuff going on also. So I don't feel so unique at all. I really don't. Not at all. Because those situations happen all the time, you know, with people.
Absolutely. But in my head, I'm thinking that you're all torn up about it inside.
No, not really. Not really. Because for one thing, moving to where I live in Texas, it's like there's a joke around here. You throw a stick out in the woods and you're going to knock somebody's guitar out of tune. There are so many musicians here. Wimberley, the town I live in, is a huge musical stuff here. There's really famous artists that live around here, and the places to play are good, and all the musicians are really good. You know, I just stepped into a different kind of a setting there.
You left in 89, right?
Yeah.
And then when did you come back into the band?
2000 and either 11 or 12, something like that. And that was when I was talking about Russell was calling me up to ask me to come and stand in for Larry when he was ill.
Right.
You know, and couldn't make it. So, okay, I was still working at this company that I worked at. The thing is, I live in a beautiful place and I didn't take any time off because, boy, driving home is just like going to a resort practically. So I had all this time that I'd never taken. And Russell showed me the amount of days that were off for the next year. And Larry was almost not going out again. And it's like, I had that many days. I could do it without even losing the job. you know, because they had all the time off. So I said, yeah. And the cool thing about Russell, he called up my wife and said, what would you think if Jules went back on the road again? And she is an artist herself. She's a published poet. And she said, yeah, yeah, okay. So for that year, I would go out on the road and come back. You know, I mean, there's no problem. Larry couldn't do it. He got sicker and sicker and sicker. And finally, he had to quit, you know. And then Russell asked me, said, what would you think about this? You know, is coming back permanently. I had to think about it. But I had been in that company for 16 years and I was ready to retire from it. So the timing was just perfect. You know, I said, okay. So I got back in the band. The schedule that we have, pretty easy. It's really not bad, you know.
Who is the band now? You're leading the band, right? Is
it myself, Jim Yester, Del Ramos, Larry's brother, who's been in the band since 74 or something like that, Brian's son, Jordan, Paul Holland, and Chris Pichter, who's been in the band almost as long as drummer. Almost as long as Dale. Brian's son's been in there for, I think, 25 years or something like that.
So it's been...
Yeah, that's where the band is now.
So that's 9 years, and you guys are locked in as a unit for 9 years, right?
Yeah.
That's pretty good. And then in 2018, the first unofficial biography of the band, The Association Cherish, written by Malcolm
Searles.
That was published, and you guys are just motoring along and now putting together, you know, I don't know, I'm dying to hear the direction that your next visit to the recording studio brings to you.
Okay, after Malcolm wrote that book, Russell wrote a book, and it's out now. And then there is another one that just came out called Rivals of the Beatles, and we're in that one. They gave us 38 pages or something like that. The guy got a lot of the information wrong, but he's a good writer.
Between Malcolm and Russell's book, which do you feel is the more accurate?
Both of them, because I know Russell checked out all of his stuff. Malcolm's is more an academic work. It's 400 and some pages long. It's more a picture of LA and the folk rock phenomena with us in the middle of it. Russell's is a fun read. It's like it's a summer book, you know, take that one to the beach. And this other one, The Rivals of the Beatles, well, I don't know, not too great, because he's really wrong about a lot of the stuff, which is very unfortunate. Some of the things he says, it's very easy to check that fact-wise, you know, and he didn't, obviously.
So I wrote a very small piece here, you know, because taking in all your work in one fell swoop, you know, the great gift that I get doing this show is I get to have a bird's eye view of a band's arc, of what their arc truly was.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So here's my takeaway. From a place of endless harmonic and musical potential and a scent that you guys picked up in the Los Angeles air that only teased out the possibilities in your sound and approach, you entered the public consciousness on a magic carpet of breathy vapor. It seems to me...
All right.
It seems to me you were a bunch of freaky types who were attenuated by the curious blade of public perception and latterly seen as Squaresville, USA. But a careful look back reveals a hell of a lot more than the singles and a hell of a lot more than a goddamn slow dance as well. You created a mood and a style that shall remain undimmed far after both of you pass from this mortal coil, regardless of whatever concerns the two of you may have about history and its fickle hindsight. I don't know what the band means to the two of you. You know, Jules, you're still very much in it. Terry, you strike me, I could be totally wrong, you strike me as a guy who ceased leading with, hello, I'm the association guy, Terry Kirkman, a long time ago. You seem like you're more recovery Terry than association Terry, or more like Mr. Heidi, you know, which is wonderful. You've moved on with your life. Terry, where do you stand in your relationship with the association? Is it just one of many, many things that you did with your life, all of which are equally important? What does the association mean to you?
It's not a one-off question.
Mm-hmm.
I think for most of my life, my whole name was, I'd like you to meet Terry, he wrote Cherish. That was my whole name.
Right.
I was really excited when I got a job writing game shows. I wrote Name That Tune. And it was really exciting to be introduced as, I'd like you to meet Terry, he's our writer. As low down on the rung of the ladder of writerhood as the game show could be. It was really nice to have another, I'd like you to meet Terry, he runs our chemical dependency groups. I'd like you to meet Terry, he's our clinical director of math. I was just, give me another title.
Is the legacy of this band important to you, or is it just as important or unimportant as anything else going in your life?
The legacy of the band is important to me because we were a really integral part of one of the most transformative times in creativity in Hollywood, the West Coast ever. I mean, absolutely ever. You want to be a fly on the wall. You want to be an integral part. You want to be somebody that was actually in the car when that happened, that kind of stuff. I think being in an integral part of the Monday Night Hoot Daddies at the Troubadour would give you cred. Anyone who was there would give you credibility and a historically valuable spokesperson for the day. On Facebook, there's a Troubadour reunion the years between 64 and 74 that I went to and did not get much attention. It really was the people who had worked at the Troubadour. And they are the people that don't get interviewed that you should be interviewing. They carry a whole lot of fucking stories between that stage and the dressing room and backstage and afterwards.
Yeah, Terry's really telling you something true here, man. The Troubadour was the center of folk rock in L.A. That was it. It's where it started, man. No one, McCabe's down the street was pretty good, but they were still, folk music, rock and roll, they're all bluesy. And then the place that Randy Sparks had was just nothing but starlets and rich people.
The Roxy was started by the rest of the show business moguls to offset Doug Weston's power over the thing. He'd have a contract with you that you had to come back and sing at the club at the same rate that he gave you for X amount of time. So the Eagles hated him. but the truth is that Joni Mitchell, Elton John, the Eagles all debuted in Hollywood at the Troubadour. And I was at a lot of those because I was no longer in the band. I like it that we were a critical part of the legacy. I like that Stephen Sondheim and Leonard Bernstein thought we were one of the two most creative bands in the country. I love that.
Thank you.
God damn it.
Thank you, boy.
So, yeah, I felt really, really lucky. Everything was an accident. I did not set out to do a single thing that you're talking to me about now. I didn't set out to be a second career recovery person. I got a phone call. I didn't set out to be the clinical director of BAP. I got a phone call. Doug Dillard had not asked me to get up on stage that night. If he had not had the vision to do the inner tubes, who knows? Do you know the name Curly Walters? He came up to me in the entryway to the Troubadour one night after the men got off the stage. And he pulled me aside and says, "You got a really good thing happening here, and it's never going to happen. And I really support you to take this energy and really fatherly make good out of this." This is like in October, November of 1964. He says the spring, and he gave me a date, the spring of 1965, all the major labels are going to pull the plug on folk music. He says, "We are so oversaturated that we can't honor our catalog at all. We're done. A couple of acts may hang around, but no one is going to sign you. I can almost guarantee you that." It turned out the Warner Brothers, I was told, had an interest in the men, but that was ex post facto. That was after we broke up. It's just a business, and it's run by marketing. And once you understand that marketing, no matter how good your product is, what's marketing has kind of systemically decided that you're not a hot topic anymore, you essentially are through. That is through with all the writers, that's through with the producers, that's through with the movie stars. It's just a fucking business. And I belong to the fucking unions of almost all the fucking business.
Speaking of the business, how did you guys make out post-1972 with publishing? You had some enormous hits.
No, publishing just goes on.
You were taken care of as time went on, right? I mean,
well, no, you could be dead, you could go away, but if your songs are still getting played, they generate what they do. I know the Warner Brothers just came through a week ago because Russ was calling me every day saying, "You got your Warner Brothers check? You got your Warner Brothers check?"
I got the same phone call.
You answer the phone and say, "Hello.
Did you get your Warner Brothers check?"
"Hi, this is Russ. No, nothing.
Did you get your Warner Brothers check?"
Yeah, we were real fortunate because we signed with Beachwood Music as a publisher, which is Capitol's, that's Capitol's publishing company. We didn't get on their label, but they got us in the publishing company.
They got us into a publishing company and they gave us a deal that nobody else had.
Yeah.
Herb Handler gave it to the association, shared 50% of domestic publishing that the band itself shared without any ownership of copyright. You didn't own the tangible, but the group still shares 50% of the publishing of domestic royalties. Never been done before. They were thinking that we were just going to be the hottest fucking thing, that Herb Handler didn't know what to do with himself, that he signed us. So he was creating new ways to sign us. He took me in. The president of Capitol Records was a guy by the name of Alexander Jules. Had me into their office and offered me $25,000 in 1965, $66 to influence the group to sign away all of their writing, all poetry, novels, anything, because they knew that we were interested in screenplays. And we had this book called Crank Your Spreaders that was nothing more than a fan club book. If you're lucky, you get it for 26 cents someplace. And if you're not lucky, you get it for $76 on eBay. All the subterfuge that I was offered $25,000 to convince the group to sign with them. I don't know what I'm fucking doing that. I have no idea what anybody's creativity is. Almost the end of Herb Handler's and my very special relationship. We're very, very involved with my wife while we were on the road in terms of taking her to dinner. And I think he thought he was going to be the godfather to my daughter.
What were you going to say there, David?
I was going to say, do you guys want to hear what your three best records are and what your worst record is?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
I like to couch it in objective terms because my opinion my opinion is fact. It's not really.
Oh, of course.
You guys know what that's like. All right. Your top three records. Number three, Inside Out. And number one and two are very close for me, but two is Birthday. One is And Then Along Comes the Association. Your worst record is your self-titled one, I think.
Stonehenge one?
Yeah.
That's our worst record?
I believe so.
You should never talk to me again.
I don't think, to be fair, I don't think you guys have a bad record. I just think.
Oh, I think we do.
So what do you guys think is your three best in order and your worst?
Oh, God, I don't know. But some of those songs that the band put out were just, I didn't think too great. You know, I can't do that, what you're doing. I can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, it's hard to have a detachment.
Too much involved in them to, you know.
I want to say that music means just about everything to me. It's, if anything, from being a teenager to being a 51-year-old man, it means more to me now than it ever did.
Well, yeah.
Besides my friends and family, it's the most important thing to me. And your music, which I come back to again and again and again, it's a mainstay for me.
Cool.
It's not just something I have on in the background. It's not just something that reminds me of a time gone by or a very tangible thing that is a mood setter and it makes me feel really good. Some of the stuff like, you know, Everything That Touches You is a great example of, you know, I feel buoyed up by this incredible spirit of compassion. Brotherhood. And I would love for you guys to know that because the band is riding what could surely be called the oldies circuit or what have you.
Oh, sure.
But in the year 2023, this music is just as viable to me now as it must have been at that time.
Good. I'm glad.
Words are important right now. I think that what you said is a 51-year-old obsessive guy about music. What you said about us with all the comparatives that you have, as an obsessive consumer, and I'm going to assume that you've listened to music that would represent maybe 75-80% of the broad genre that we're talking about. I think that you think that highly of us is a pretty good synopsis of when I think to myself, we weren't all that bad. How was your group? We weren't that bad. How was your group? Well, for a group that had no intention of ever going on to be the group that we were pretty fucking good. There was some really interesting shit that came out of the thing. When I sit down and I listen to, say, Ted Blachel's stuff, and I think, God, I would have liked to have had a hand in helping him write that. Well, that wasn't ever going to happen because it was this guy in the group that I was in that I didn't have a relationship with that I could have had a hand in helping him do that. In terms of the system, in terms of a creative system, a systemic thing, we never really coexisted. I was really surprised when I was reading the songs that Randy Meister wrote, that I assumed that Fry and what's his name wrote.
and we make those assumptions. I don't know any groups that really hung together and were nice to each other after they broke up.
Yourselves included?
I think we probably did a little bit better than a lot. I know firsthand the Sour Grapes, the Loving Spoonful. I know the Sour Grapes, not even any grapes in the fucking bowl with Blood, Sweat, and Tears, stuff like that. And somewhere along the line, it's like, where have you worked before? Well, I worked at the association for 7.5 years, then I worked at the association for another 4. And it's like, where else did you work? Well, I worked over here, and I worked over here, and I worked over there, and I worked over there. Jules is the only person in the association that I've ever really cared about.
He's your best friend, right?
Oh, God. We've known each other since, Christ, I was 17.
1962.
Yeah.
We were in a little party place. He was 18 years old. He had on a Pendleton shirt, and he had a Greek high wrap around your leg. Go up around, and we're talking to some little co-ed, Waikiki Beach co-ed tourist. And Jules leans down and says, and points at the bottom of his Pendleton shirt. And that was my introduction to Jules. It was the tip of his dick hanging down at the bottom of the... Actually, Jules and I met on a very rainy night.
Wait, hold on. Go back to Jules's penis. What the hell were you saying?
No, that was it.
This is the same night.
The girl screamed and ran away. And I just thought, well, you're an interesting guy. Jules and I met in a den, in a place that was shared by two doctors, young guys. And it was a classic Hawaiian rainy night where you don't want to step outside. No one will ever see you again, particularly when you're uphill. You just be swept out to sea. And we're under a flag hanging on the wall. There was a black flag with a yellow circle in the middle of it. And in the middle of the circle with the initials FYF, and we were in rarefied Honolulu space of really rebellious people, doctors who were doing anything that they could to raise money for abortion clinics on the Mexican border before abortion was legal. I was told that they would run guns, drugs, anything to get the money to do what they were doing, and all the money they were getting was torn. But the initials in the circle meant fuck your mother.
That's what I figured, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. Terry, I was driving on the 405, and there was a car with a flag with an FYM on it. And I tried to catch up with him, but I couldn't do it. It was still alive long after.
You know, at the risk of sounding homoerotic, which is not what this is intended as. No, seriously, from the very start, which is one of the reasons that I really wanted to get Jules on the program with you, Terry, is that I see this as a love story. The love that two men can have for each other when there's this much history. And what makes it even more special and makes it more rarefied to me is that unlike a trio or even a foursome like the Beatles or so many other kinds of groups, you guys had so many members, first as the men, then tons of members in the association, and then the lineup changes, all the insanity you guys went through, Brian's passing, and you weathered it, and you guys are still close, which is, you know, the reason why when I think of this thing coming full circle and you guys, even if it's just a cursory creative collaboration that happens for this new record, it's a notion that feels good to me because ultimately that's the thing that matters most is that you guys are still friends.
Oh, yeah. In fact, probably better now than ever. Probably better because we're adults, you know, we're not just crazy kids out there just getting high and, you know, doing whatever like that. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I guarantee you we're better friends now than we were then.
That's a good feeling, you know, because the harmony in your music, it means nothing at the end of the day if you can't have harmony between you.
Oh, yeah.
Every couple of days, I'd be reporting back to Terry. Jules still hasn't noticed that I messaged him on Facebook. You know, I'm like trying to get at you. Because I know this, the two of you guys, that's really where it's at. I can't thank you enough for the time you put into this, for caring as much as you have about it. And one short thing is Terry warned me before we went into this. He was trying to shake me up a little bit by telling me, you know, who you think we are, we're not those people. You know, you wanted to make sure I didn't see you guys as deities or anything like that. And the human beings that are sitting here before me are a lot more impressive progressive than what I thought you guys were.
Well, David, continuing, I got to thank you for doing this. We've never done anything like this. I hate fucking interviews, to tell you the truth. I hate them. But this has been a total, total wonderful trip. And I really appreciate what you're doing. And, you know, you as a human being. Wow. Cool dude, man.
Thanks.
You know?
How would you rate Dave's show?
First of all, I'd have to see it edited, because you know he's going to edit the shit out of him. If he doesn't, he's crazy, you know?
Oh, yeah.
But I know it's going to be, boy, I wouldn't even want to be around you during the editing of this, because this is going to take a while, man.
It is.
You know, but this is amazing. This is just amazing. I'd give him a 4. Or 4.5. Maybe. Okay, 5. Fuck it.
How about you, Terry? I know you're going to be harsher.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I feel kind of professorial here. This is not a work done. You've gone out and you have gathered all the sticks and poles that you need to put something together here.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that as somebody that's been on the development end of a lot of documentaries. I would give you a really strong 3 as a 51-year-old man, as enthusiastic as you are and as invested in your opinion as you are. You're going to have to work around that. As a documentary and as a historical guy, you've got to work around your opinion. But you're a 51-year-old, really enthusiastic fan of music of two guys in their 80s. Are you in your 80s yet?
No, September. Close enough.
You follow what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So there is an experiential gap. There's a systemic gap. There's a dialect gap that as you pursue your love for our era of music, don't get out there and trip over your best intentions. Or as we used to say in NBC when I was writing Name That Tune, don't trip over your own dick. You don't get out there and say, well, I think, whoops, he tripped over his own dick. You know, drop the investment, because all art is all contextual. Where was the guy sitting when he wrote this? What was he eating?
Right.
How cold was it outside? Was it during the Depression? Everything comes out of that situational tube, and you can't escape it. So for the association to be in 1964 with the 60s as we do, well, 63 it already have, so that's a big deal in the South. And Vietnam was not something I knew about it because we lived in Hawaii. The rest of the United States is just something we were doing over there. But we were at the absolute cusp, the absolute brink of huge, unthinkable cultural change that nobody really could have predicted it. And when you happen to be caught up in that particular tsunami and it washes you up Sunset Boulevard and you go, holy fuck, holy fuck, holy fuck, holy fuck, holy fuck, wow, ooh, did you hear that? I just thought, Jesus fucking Christ, what was that? I don't know. Have you ever seen that before, Jules? No, man. We can't.
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, I saw that one. What time is it?
Then you factor in really good marijuana and LSD.
Oh, Jesus, yes.
Ubud and Ratatouille. Then you factor in this, you factor in that. Nobody saw that coming. So we were caught up in a dialectic tumbler.
Yeah, you certainly were. You guys were, in a sense, the Schrodinger's cat of groups, because you were the Straits and the Freaks.
Yeah, and we were both dead and alive.
I was the only non-Mexican that I know of smoking dope in Chino High School in 1957. I'm sure there were some others. But I had a secret.
No repercussions there. I only wish, Terry, that you were accompanying me to Staten Island next weekend so that we could play footsie with Jules under the table at dinner. But I very much look forward.
Are you going to have dinner with him, Jules?
Are you still able to meet up for dinner before the show?
More than likely, yeah. You bet. Are we done here?
We unfortunately are. I'd like to just start at the beginning and just do it all over again if you guys are up.
Oh, yeah, let's do that.
Guys, I can't thank you enough. Your music means a lot to me and to a lot of other people.
Thank you.
And at the risk of sending you running screaming, I love you both very much as people.
Oh, thank you. Absolutely. Yeah, it's great to meet you, man.
Yeah, you too.
Let's keep this shit up.
You are now part of my psyche, bro.
It only took 13 hours, huh?
Love you all.
Love you all. Talk to you soon. soon, Terry. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys. All right, that about does it. A heartfelt Discography thanks goes out to my beautiful wife and son, Jen and Mason, Terry Kirkman, Jules Alexander, and Ruth Ann Friedman, my incredibly loyal fans, and especially the entire Patreon community, the Soldiers of Sound. I love every last one of you, and this show would not exist without you, my friends. Speaking of friends, it's high time for some new ones. They're in our Facebook group, Discography Soldiers of Sound. That's the best way to find out what's coming up on the show, but there's a hell of a lot more. You get recaps of the day in music history, the ability to pitch questions to guests, polls that put you in the driver's seat on guest and band decisions, access to a thriving creative hub if you're looking for a collaborator, and much more. So make sure you don't miss out. You can find the link to the Discography Soldiers of Sound Facebook page right there in the show notes. And if you don't mess with the Zuck, I get it. Just email me at info@discography.com and I'll keep you in the loop. So now that it's done and you want more, another way to dive even deeper into the magical sounds of creamy 1960s gold is to visit episode 1 of this series, episode 109, Vashti Bunyan, episodes 103 and 104, Burt Summer, 83 and 84, David Crosby, 77 and 78, The Zombies with Lou Barlow, numbers 59 and 60, The Monkees, episodes 22 and 23, and part one of the Bee Gees, when they were all treacly and hadn't yet found out that they were disco kings and that the universe preferred their chests bare. That's episode number 10. I want to also say that for the first time in the show's history, since Patreon began, we are not doing Monday and Wednesday shows. And the reason for that is these episodes for the association are very long. They run from an hour and a half to 2.5 hours. Some of our shows are 30, 40 minutes. Initially, what I was planning on doing was cutting out all the many digressions and doing a big Patreon thing of, you know, all the, not outtakes, but stuff that didn't wind up in the episode. And then I just decided at a certain point that the whole idea of this series was its length, was its marathon type of feel to it. So I made it as close to a marathon as possible and then just decided no alternate shows, no nothing. This is the thing. And believe me, you'll be getting your listening value out of this series. However, do make sure that you visit patreon.com/discograffiti and check out the thematically related deep dive as a music obsessive's way of life. Our Patreon's been up and running for a year, and with 2 episodes a week, there are close to 100 Patreon episodes at this point. That's an entire universe available to you for the price of a cup of coffee a week. And of course, be sure to mark your calendars, because next Friday, September 29th, we are back to our hallowed 3-show-a-week schedule, and we're veering as far away as we can from the soft pop of yesteryear as we barrel into a doubleheader featuring Pavement's Bob Nastanovich. Come now, where are you going to find a podcast that veers so wildly in all directions at once? Nowhere, that's where. Trust me, you're not going to want to miss it. And so, from now till then, don't let our youth go to waste, lads and ladies. It's Discograffiti.